The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul. And then
hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek. I'm joined, as always, by my friend and comrade, Danny Bessner. And we're very pleased to welcome to the program Eldar Mammadov. Eldar is a Brussels-based foreign policy expert. He has long experience working with the European Union. He's also a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute. Eldar, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So one aspect of the war with Iran that we haven't talk too much about on this show yet, and I wanted to get you on because you've been commenting on this, I've seen quite a bit, has been the way that European institutions and European governments have managed or tried to manage their relationship with the United States and their nominal interest in upholding, you know, little things like international law or humanitarian law, and not doing, in my opinion, such a great job. Can you just sort of, in a very broad sense, kind of take people through what you've observed in terms of how Europe has been trying to straddle the divide here and whether they've been successful at it?
Well, I think that European reactions to the illegal war in Iran is a masterclass in inconsistency. At the beginning, European countries, with the exception of Spain, they took a position which was largely supportive of the U.S.-Israel attack on Iran. The German Chancellor Friedrich Merz was particularly outspoken, and this is the same person who, back in June last year, said regarding the 12 days war that Israel was doing dirty work for Europeans on behalf of Western democracies. That was an infamous statement that he made. And other countries like France, they were sort of hesitant, recognizing on the one hand that this war is, as President Macron said, outside the framework of international law, but at the same time also putting so many caveats that it really did sound like they were basically fine with that war. And that is because the regime in Iran is seen as such a fundamental evil that its removal trumps everything else, including respect for international law. Again, Spain was an outlier, with Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez taking very principled and very clear position against the war as a violation of international law, even though, of course, he also condemned the Iranian regime for the repression, the most recent bout of repression in January. But he also made it very clear that military action, let alone illegal, is not a way to deal with these issues. So, but then when it was clear that the American-Israeli operation didn't go according to the plan was the rapid decapitation and then unraveling the whole regime, an installment of a new regime. So that plan clearly failed. And then we've seen how European leaders started modifying their rhetoric and moving closer to the position that the Spanish Prime Minister took from the outset. So now we see that Italy, France, they're not allowing to use their airspace and American basis in the case of Italy for attack on Iran. UK has refused full-blown support for the war either. So, and even Germany, even Merz, who's very enthusiastic at the beginning, as I said, he's now talking about the dangers of disintegration of Iran. Of course, Iran is a country of more than 90 million people, and disintegration would mean flows of refugees, where would they be heading? To Europe, of course. So now we see much more cautious rhetoric, which in my opinion is still not enough, not nearly enough. Just today we've seen a statement by President of European Council, Antonio Costa, who sort of speaks on behalf of EU heads of states and governments. And he says that there is only diplomatic solution that is possible to this conflict. And he referenced his recent phone call with President of Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian. But even so, he still fails to bring himself to clearly point to the culprits of this situation, to clearly name U.S. and Israeli aggression, illegal war on aggression on Iran, as the root cause of this situation. And that, in my opinion, is the key weakness of the positions of most European leaders. Again, Spain is an outlier. Even though they recognize now that the war has been gone badly wrong, and they recognize that there must be diplomatic solution, but they still hesitate to name the perpetrators, which of course provides a glaring contrast with their reactions on the Russian invasion to Ukraine. But there was no hesitancy whatsoever to name who was the aggressor, impose sanctions, all of those steps, rightly so. But in this case, we see this refusal to name who is the aggressor. And I believe this is the fundamental weakness of European position, and it strongly undermines European credibility on the world stage.
Even though they haven't gone as far as, you know, you would necessarily like, the shift in tone from the early days of the war to now is striking. And I do you think there was a specific point at which the tide started to turn? Is it just the dawning realization that the U.S. really didn't have any idea how to get out of this war, that it started, like, it started a war expecting it to be over in 2 days, and then, you know, now it's just sort of open-ended, and they're starting to get nervous about that? Like, I mean, you talk about, like, in the early days of the conflict, after the initial strike that killed Ali Khamenei, and things seemed to be happening very quickly, the statements that were coming out of Europe were just amazing, like demanding that Iran stop firing and come back to the negotiating table when they were the ones that had been attacked and they were retaliating for it. Like, it's just astonishing stuff. And now we've come to sort of halfway, kind of half-hearted statements of international law. And it feels like maybe born out of just a sense that the U.S. got into a war it doesn't know how to end. I don't know if you think there was some other kind of more immediate trigger that caused the shift or not.
Well, I think it's pretty clear what happened. In the first days, there was really sort of hope or assumption that this was really going to go very quickly with the decapitation of the regime. Now, why would European governments assume such a thing? That would be a big mystery to me. Presumably, they have intelligence, and even American intelligence was not at all as optimistic as President Trump appears to have thought of this operation. But I think the main point is that the European leaders did not want to upset President Trump. And that is because there is still this perception that the United States is absolutely vital for European defense and security, especially in the context of the ongoing war in Ukraine. So I would say that there was this, you know, real wish for that operation to go quickly and smoothly. And frankly, no one would shed any tears for the Iranian regime in Europe. The assumption was that it would be possible to go back to the core security concern for Europeans, which is Russia and Ukraine. Of course, none of that went according to the plan. And I think in a few days, Europeans started realizing that the United States has no plan, has no strategy. But the fallout, particularly economic fallout, in terms of rise of energy prices, rise of inflation, the fallout could be catastrophic from this war. So, and that is what, when the point at which they started sort of changing gears towards more diplomacy.
It really is astonishing that nobody in Europe saw this coming or saw the possibility that the Iranians could close the Strait of Hormuz, that they could, you know, send global oil prices, natural gas prices skyrocketing, that they would attack energy sites in the Gulf. Like, you could have predicted all of this. Do you think it's a case of European leaders just sort of, for reasons that, you know, are past my ability to understand, just relying on the U.S. to have, or on Donald Trump in particular, to have gamed this all out and you know, have planned for contingencies? Like, what explains the lack of agency or the inability to envision how bad this could get for Europe and to kind of respond to it on that basis?
It's completely self-inflicted. If you look a little bit back and see what happened with JCPOA in 2015, because I think that's relevant for the broader perspective to understand why we, as Europeans, why we are in this situation. So when Trump withdraws from JCPOA in 2018, the Europeans fail to make JCPOA work within the United States. I mean, in the sense of failing to provide economic backbone for the agreement from which Iran could benefit, which it was entitled to according to the terms of JCPOA. So I think that's where the European road to perdition started when it comes to Iran. Instead of standing up for JCPOA, Europeans chose to play second fiddle to the United States. Then fast forward to 2023, when the snapback of the UN Security Council sanctions was introduced, not by the United States, because the United States has withdrawn from the agreement by then, but by UK and France, European allies. So what does that mean? That means that Europeans have lost any leverage they had on Iran, and which could have enabled them to play a constructive role in the run-up to the war, and maybe perhaps even contribute to avoiding the war. So they cut themselves off and now found themselves in a situation when Europe has no proper agency, has no relevancy on that file. And by the way, it's quite interesting, again, back to that statement that I mentioned by Antonio Costa, the president of the EU Council. He says on the one hand that there can only be diplomatic solution to this war. And then elsewhere in his statement, he says that he relies on efforts of the regional partners to bring that diplomatic solution about. So where is Europe? Europe was part of the JCPOA, was part of diplomatic outreach to Iran since early 2000s. So now Europe is simply not in the picture. The best we can do is just to rely on regional partners, Oman, Qatar, Pakistan, Turkey, that they could somehow facilitate the diplomatic solution. So that alone already tells you all you need to know about Europe. It's just remarkable how the E3 and the European Union, how they completely wasted the credibility and the leverage they had on Iran.
So this leads me to a broader question about what do you think this all suggests first about Europe's relationship with the United States? Obviously, Mark Carney is someone who exists transatlantically. He's in Canada, but he was in the UK for a while. You have criticisms of Trump, but then people support Iran. What does this say first about the European-US relationship from a macro perspective, and then about the relative role of Europe as a power region in the world, particularly as we move away from unipolarity towards something that seems to at least be resembling multipolarity?
Well, I think there is a growing realization that the United States, particularly President Donald Trump, is not a reliable partner. And we see clearly we see that clearly in the reactions from the White House. you know, from all the ecosystem of the MAGA movement and neoconservatives, of course, who are now all lashing out at Europe for not helping the United States in Iran. So what does that mean? What message does it send? It sends the message that basically Washington expects European allies not to act as allies, but simply as submissive vassals. This administration seems to be treating Europe as a kind of colony, using the European dependence on NATO and on Washington on security and defense, use this as a leverage to force complete submission of Europe to whims of the President of the United States without any need to consult, to ask for an opinion. Basically, if the United States decides to attack any country, and in this case it's Iran, then Europe is simply expected to join, no questions asked. So even the most fervent Atlanticists in Europe, they start realizing that this is not an arrangement that is sustainable in the long run. Of course, you still have people like Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, who painstakingly tries to portray a picture of widespread support for Trump in NATO, but he's contradicted by NATO member states, like Spain, for example, who are very explicit in their rejection of this whole war. So, yeah, on the one hand, you still have these diehard Atlanticists who are pushing the line that, yeah, okay, maybe the administration was not very, let's say, diplomatic or exquisite in its manners regarding the Europeans in not informing them and not sharing with them their plans on Iran. But still, Europeans have to help the U.S. Because of broader transatlantic relationship and, of course, because of Ukraine and Russia. But I see more and more in foreign policy circles the alternative point of view is gaining ground, and that is that you cannot build your own future, your own security, on the whims of a mercurial president in the United States. And therefore, the old idea of French President Macron about the strategic autonomy for Europe, now it's gaining ground. And I think we'll see more of that as we go forward.
I want to talk about, you mentioned it already, the issue of the use of European bases by the U.S. military to carry out this war, and the hair splitting that's gone in many cases to trying to allow enough, like the U.S. to use them enough that Trump doesn't get mad, but, you know, to in some way try to draw an artificial line that says, look, we're not combatants in this war. We're not party to it. We're not, you know, actually involved in it, which just seems futile to me. But I think of, like, you know, some of the things, the hoops that Keir Starmer has jumped through, you know, in terms of allowing the use of Diego Garcia for defensive strikes on Iran, which in a war of pure aggression, of the war of choice of pure aggression, the concept that you could be undertaking any defensive strikes against Iran is just bizarre. But I wonder what you make of this kind of attempt at hair splitting, especially when it doesn't buy them anything. Like, Trump is still mad. He's still talking about, you know, we don't have a relationship with the UK anymore, and Keir Starmer's, you know, on my bad list. Like, it doesn't get them anywhere. So what is the sort of rationale to it?
Well, I think, as I said, they're trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, the war is extremely unpopular on the European continent, just as it is in the United States, but it's perhaps even more unpopular in Europe. The politicians cannot simply ignore that. But on the other hand, there's also tremendous pressure, not from the population, but from transatlantic, say, circles, deep state, you can call it, the ecosystem of... you know, think tanks, defense industry, etc., who are pushing for this more hawkish position, and particularly in the UK, with their, you know, special relationship dating back decades, that inertia is very strong, that UK in all cases has to stand next to the United States. So I think Keir Starmer is balancing these pressures, and he's trying to wiggle his way out of it, which on the one hand would ensure that UK is not participating actively in a war of aggression, in a war that is contrary to international law. But on the other hand, also, he takes care not to burn that special relationship and transatlantic link. Now, if you ask me whether that gambit is playing out for him, I would say rather no, because as you rightly pointed out, he doesn't seem to elicit, you know, high regard from President Trump, who actually, you know, spoke rather derisively about him, saying that he's no Churchill and so on. So I think as it becomes more and more apparent that only unconditional submission to the hegemon would satisfy current American government, the more it will dawn on European leaders that there is simply absolutely nothing they can do short of this unconditional submission, even when it goes so patently against the interests of their own countries, their own political interests, and the interests of their people. So I think this realization is coming, perhaps too slow, but the trajectory, at least in Western Europe, the trajectory is, to me, is quite clear.
The pressure that comes from the think tank community or the sort of Atlanticist commentariat. I know you probably saw this. Like, there was a post from Michael McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia,
friend of the pod.
Sort of friend of the pod. Yeah, we've asked him, you know, so many times to come on. No, but like basically putting the onus at the doorstep of the European governments and calling it imprudent for them not to just let the U.S. military use these bases as it wants to attack Iran. The attitude seems to be, even if they wouldn't say this overtly, that Europe is really just an adjunct in the United States. Like, there's no autonomy, there's no independence. It's just a regional division of the U.S. empire, and they should just do what they're told. There's no concept of, and I you know, said this in response to that post, like, if you want to talk about prudence, the prudent thing for the U.S. to have done would have been to talk to these governments ahead of time and say, look, we're going to have a war. We need to use these bases. Is that okay? Can we arrange this? But they didn't do any of that. They just popped this on Europe as they did with everybody else. And so putting the onus then on the Europeans to bend over backwards, it just feels like there's really no recognition that Europe is an entity or that European, you know, countries have any strategic autonomy from the U.S.
Well, it's superbly ironic that you just mentioned Mike Fall, who was actually high-ranking ambassador under Obama administration. And then you also have Ari Fleischer, the former spokesman for President George W. Bush, who offloaded his disappointment and anger at Europeans singling out France, especially, for failing to support U.S. In Iran. So we see some kind of bipartisan, hawkish, neoconservative/liberal interventionist consensus here. And I think that those in the U.S. who truly value relations with Europe and transatlantic, you know, alliance, they should be very worried. This kind of language, this kind of attitude actually undermines that very alliance that they pretend to be cherishing. And I think in the long run, it's very counterproductive to the United States, because having strong, capable, economically prosperous allies, such as European countries, is indispensable in the world where the United States has geopolitical adversaries is Russia and China. So by consciously or unconsciously dismantling this alliance with this sort of rhetoric and this sort of actions, I think that's imprudent and to some extent I would even say quite reckless, parting from point of view of interest of the United States.
Something else you started to allude to in your previous answer that I want to kind of pull on a little bit is where the publics, the voting publics in these European countries are at, kind of watching their governments bend over backwards, basically, for the United States and get nothing out of it, you know, but ridicule from Donald Trump. And it puts those leaders, I would think, in a pretty humiliating light. At the same time, you know, the alternative to a lot of these administrations, the sort of centrist governments in the UK and in, you know, even Germany and France, is the far right. The active alternative is the far right, which is tied on some level, ideologically, if nothing else, to the Trump administration. You've got people in the Trump administration openly rooting for far right parties to win European elections. So there's definitely a bond there. Are those parties going to be discredited? What are we seeing any of them try to distance themselves from the U.S. on nationalist grounds, even, you know, like on sovereignty grounds? What has this had any impact, I guess, on the discourse, the political discourse?
Yes, the situation varies in different countries. But if we just take the biggest ones, like France and Germany, they will clearly see that this kind of nationalist conservative or far-right parties, they clearly have taken a position which is quite critical with the U.S. war in Iran. In France, the far-right party, National Rally, has been quite clear about, rejecting this operation, which actually also the far left shares the same position. But I think Germany, for example, is quite a remarkable example. We have Alternative for Germany, which is, of course, the far-right nationalist populist party, which has taken very strong and clear position against the war. And they were very critical of the hesitant and ambiguous position of the ruling coalition. The ruling coalition, let's not forget, it's Christian Democrats led by Chancellor Friedrich Merz and Social Democrats who are much more, hesitant to support the war. And Minister of Defense Boris Pistorius, who belongs to the Social Democratic Party, was very clear on that, as was, by the way, the president, Steinmeier, who's also a social democrat, who said very clearly that this war is against international law. So we see quite an interesting convergence here. When you have a nationalist party like Alternative for Germany and the progressive center-left Spanish prime minister like Pedro Sanchez converging on the same ground, on their rejection of the war in Iran, that tells you something quite remarkable. And that means that the anti-war sentiment is spread across the political spectrum. It's not, you know, just the property of the traditional left or the right. So it's spread throughout the spectrum, which also, by the way, includes the voters of most center-right and center-left parties. Let's not forget that in Europe there is still memory of the Iraq war and of Libya war and of Syria war and of, you know, the memory of how all of that worked out is quite fresh. And there is definitely, on the popular level, there is definitely no appetite for more endless wars in the Middle East. That much is absolutely clear.
So what does this suggest, I think, taking a step back, about Europe's geostrategy going forward? They still rely on, many countries rely on the United States. There's clearly some form of divorce happening. Europe and various political parties could not like this war all they want. It hasn't really mattered. What does this mean for Europe? What do these countries want? Do they envision themselves as adopting a more nationalist geostrategy? Where is the EU as a political project, or European Union as a political project at this moment? As the world becomes more multipolar, where is Europe going to fit into that, if at all?
Well, I think clearly what's happening is forcing, you know, thinkers on European continent to rethink the transatlantic link. It's clear that what's happening in the United States with Donald Trump, it's not a temporary aberration. It was perceived as such back in 2016, and then the most elites in Europe thought, okay, that's an aberration, let's wait 4 years, then things will, you know, sort of go back to normal. With the election of Joe Biden, this is what happened on the face of it. And then Trump got elected again. And unlike in his first term, now he's much more unhinged in a way. So it's clearly a structural problem here. So to what extent does it make sense for European elites to keep pretending that things are just at some point again going to go back to normal? There is some hope with midterm elections, then with presidential elections 2028, with Democrats expected to make gains in both elections. But my sense is that there is a lot less complacency now and a lot more realization that it is simply not prudent to build your own long-term strategy, you know, dependent on whatever happens in the White House. So I think the way forward is more European strategic autonomy, more investment in defense capabilities, but frankly also more diplomatic autonomy. This is at least what I would like to see. Not just, you know, rush for rearmament as a way of insuring themselves from U.S., let's say, lowering their level of commitment to NATO. But also, I would look forward for this rediscovery of European autonomous diplomatic capacity. And there are signs of it. The Belgian Prime Minister, Bart De Wever, for example, recently suggested that it's time for Europe to start negotiations and to normalize relations with Russia. That, of course, was seen as quite a controversial statement by some member states, especially those who are closer to Russia, especially the parts on normalization. But it's clear that talking to Russia is indispensable. And it's, of course, a different question to what extent Moscow is ready to talk to Europe. But it's clear that for Europe to act as an independent actor, it has to not only invest in its defense capabilities, but also boost its diplomatic standing. And that means reaching out to adversaries such as Russia.
So, but to me, there's an issue here. I agree. I would like if diplomatic capabilities are renewed and Europe does seek a more diplomatic autonomy from the United States, I think that would be good. But there is absolutely going to have to be some investments in a defense industrial base. But Europe is facing a problem because they have spent decades basically not investing that in order to build welfare states that are better than what we have significantly in the United States. And to actually build the space, they're going to have to make, because we still live in capitalism, I don't think the revolution is here, they're going to be taking away from social welfare. But the rub is that the legitimacy of governments throughout the Western world, throughout the entire world at this point, rests on consumption, and in Europe in particular, providing welfare. So I don't see, I think that's a major reason you haven't already seen a break, which was obvious to anyone who would open their eyes 10 years ago. The reason that you don't see a break is that it would actually be very difficult to do for Europe to really invest in its defense and its weaponry to, for example, be able to meet with a Putin why would I want to meet with the Belgian, who cares? I'll talk to the big dog, Donald Trump. So how is that going to be politically feasible? Just as a political issue, it seems very difficult for Europe to actually make the strategic break, which again is why I think they haven't yet.
Well, I think coming back to what you said about Belgian Prime Minister and Putin, I think there is actually incentive on the Russian side to talk to Europeans as well. Why? It's because the talks with the Trump administration, they haven't led to anything so far. And on the American side, we see Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner negotiating everything. They negotiate Iran, they negotiate Gaza, they negotiate with Russia. Those are the people who have no diplomatic experience whatsoever. People who don't understand the value of expertise, and frankly, who are not being seen, not being taken seriously after they botched the diplomacy with Iran. Why would anyone in Moscow or elsewhere take them seriously? So I think from Russian point of view, what happened with Iran, with war was started twice in the midst of negotiations, that was a very clear message on just how unreliable the United States is. On the other hand, it's clear that Russians have to somehow to find a modus vivendi with Europe, just as Europe has to find a modus vivendi with Russia. Russians see themselves as European country, belonging to European culture. They would love to renew the economic relations with the European Union. So I think there is a case for that, which at least, at the very least, needs to be explored seriously on both sides. Now, when you speak about the political cost of putting overwhelming emphasis on defense and rearmament, yes, that is a real issue. And that comes at the expense of many social programs, of the welfare state, of the very model of European, at least Western European, way of life. And of course, it's politically costly for those governments who undertake those reforms, those steps. And I think we should be pragmatic on that. There's obviously, there needs to be investment in defense, but also we should be careful not to exaggerate, not to inflate the threats. It's not like Russia is going to invade European Union countries, the Baltic states, for example, tomorrow. There is absolutely nothing that would suggest such an intention from the Russian side. And even if there were an intention, their capabilities are simply not there. So the war in Ukraine has taken serious toll on Russian capabilities, and they will need from 5 to 10 years to rebuild those capabilities to pose a threat to Europe. So this is a time that has to be used, in my opinion, for two purposes. First, build credible deterrence without provoking. And that, of course, in itself is a huge task which should be discussed separately. But you have to be realistic and you have to build that deterrence. And the second pillar on which the strategy should be based is to find a diplomatic way of dealing with Russia, of channeling to Russians our security concerns and listening to theirs, and try to find a way to coexist, because clearly you cannot change geography.
Thinking about if when I assume, hopefully, we get to an end to the Iran war, do you see a role for the EU or for European countries individually to play here? And I'm thinking, I mean, you know, the obvious areas in policing the Strait of Hormuz, which is something that a lot of governments, I think Macron talked about this. I don't know if any other officials have talked openly about it, but the, you know, after Donald Trump sort of laid responsibility for reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which he closed at the feet of European countries and demanded that they clean up his mess, the response was, you know, that they would, there's a willingness to do some sort of policing mission, maybe some patrols after the war is over, after the fighting is stopped. They're not going to send ships in to get attacked. Do you think that there is an actual role that, the Europeans could play here? I guess I wonder, if you're the Iranians, why you would even bother engaging with Europe? And the same, you know, similar to Danny's question, like, why would you even bother at this point dealing with these people? They're ineffectual. They can't be trusted. I mean, they haven't shown themselves to be trustworthy as far as the Iranians are concerned. So I wonder about that. But maybe there is a place for the Europeans to kind of step in on some level here and police a peace deal or a ceasefire.
Well, yes, these days there is a talk about the coalition. There was a meeting in London with 30 or 40 countries talking about the need to reopen the Hormuz. The military solution has been ruled out, but then it's not very clear how exactly do they plan to accomplish that. So they are also talking, the French are talking about policing the Hormuz Straits after the war. But assuming this war is going on for some time, unfortunately, then what we see is that those countries, they are rather trying to make bilateral deals with Iran. And the Iranians have said that they would let the countries that are not part of the hostile coalition, they will let the sheikhs belonging to those countries to pass through. That happened with Spain. That happened also with France. So I would say that in principle, there is no reason why Iran would hold you know, eternal enmity towards European countries. On the other hand, had Europeans invested in safeguarding the JCPOA, had they refrained from invoking snapback at the UN Security Council, had they clearly condemned the US-Israeli aggression, both in June last year and this year, then obviously the EU and the member states would have been in a much better position to negotiate, you know, beneficial terms with Iran. And it's again, it's totally self-defeating for Europeans to have taken that position, which was either, you know, strongly supportive of the United States or very equivocating and hesitant. It was just simply counterproductive.
I have basically one more question, and it's about a specific personality. You referenced Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, former Prime Minister, now Secretary General of NATO, a little earlier. And I want to ask you, because you're, you know, you're somebody who observes European politics and observes these people. He's taken the extreme like opposite approach of, you know, the idea of autonomy or strategic independence from the US. Has taken the complete opposite approach and has decided that the best way to get through to Trump and to appeal to Trump is just to be the ultimate sycophant. And I guess I wonder, you know, when you have somebody who is a former prime minister, who's the Secretary General of NATO, referring to Trump as daddy in public, and just behaving in the way that he's behaved with respect to Trump, how does that play in Europe? Like, what is this, the sense of watching the spectacle of this man debasing himself over and over again to try and play up to Trump's ego and not really having a lot of success? I mean, he seems to have maybe calmed down the Greenland crisis for the time being, but it hasn't really bought Europe any respect from Trump beyond that, or NATO any respect from Trump beyond that. He's talking, you know, even still talking about pulling out of it. Like, how does that kind of go over, I guess, in Europe is my question when he's you know, puts on these displays?
Well, the best that could be said about it is that some people just see this as a necessary exercise to please Trump and to keep him committed to NATO for all the reasons I mentioned before, Russia, Ukraine, etc. So that's the most, let's say, benevolent interpretation of his antics. On the other hand, indeed, in view of how utterly unpredictable and even, I would say, reckless this administration is proving to be, there are clearly diminishing returns in this sort of sycophancy. And some countries are really pushing back against Rutte's line. I already mentioned Spain. Others may be not so vocal, but there's a widespread discontent in policymaking circles over, you know, this groveling to Trump. And I think Rutte probably thinks that what he's doing is necessary to strengthen the NATO and reinforce a transatlantic link and U.S. commitment to Europe. But I think what in reality what he's achieving is rather the opposite. It clearly, you know, widens the gaps within the NATO itself. This sort of debasement, self-debasement, is simply incomprehensible to increasing number of people in Europe. It's just embarrassing. But also, as you rightly said, it simply doesn't make sense, because at the end of the day, United States still, under Trump, doesn't take European allies seriously, likes to humiliate them, likes to threaten them. So what else can you do to appease this administration? It just hurts the European interests, not just self-respect. So it's totally counterproductive.
I think you could just say it's totally counterproductive and apply that pretty broadly to the way that Europe is managing itself these days with respect to the United States. But Eldar, thank you so much for coming on the program. As I said, this was an aspect of the situation that we really wanted to get into, and we really appreciate you taking us through it. And we look forward to having you back. People can find you on X, the Everything site, and we'll have any links to your work that you want us to put in the show description as well. So thank you again.
It was my pleasure being here. Thank you.